You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Third hour on this Wednesday afternoon, Darren Donick and Chase. And sad, another legendary name and coach in the SEC has left us. It was Pat Dye earlier in the week, and now you can add Johnny Majors to the list, who was certainly a legendary player and coach. And our next guest, I thought his quote was pretty much sums it up. When you think Johnny Majors, that name, it's synonymous with Tennessee football. And Jimmy Himes now joins us. He's afternoon host on Sports Animal WNML there in Knoxville. Jimmy, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, guys. I hope you are as well.
Yep. Thanks for doing this. I don't think there's anybody in that market that knew Johnny Majors better than you. So just kind of take us down memory lane. I'll turn it over to you because you knew him best.
Well, I had a great relationship with him, and I've told people I can't think of any coaches that I enjoyed covering more than John Majors. He was very honest. He was very open. He was colorful. He was a great storyteller. I love going to practice and watching him practice and his interaction with players and coaches, although I will tell you, he was tough to play for and he was tough to coach for, no doubt about that. But I enjoyed that. Our relationship continued to evolve. When he left to go to Pitt and then came back, he started having monthly luncheons in Knoxville. I spoke at a couple of them. I attended many of them. We had a chance to play golf a few times together, and I really got pretty close to him. And the thing that kind of stands out to me when I heard the news this morning is that, and I called him now and then just to check on him, how you doing? I happened to call him May 21st. And he said, you know, this is my birthday. I said, no, I didn't know it was your birthday. He said, yeah. He said, I've turned 85 today. He said, I never thought I'd live to be 60. And I thought, well, I'm glad you made it to 85. But the last thing he said was, hey, we're going to go have lunch when this virus thing clears up. And I'm going to hold it to you. You have to call me. So don't you forget, we're going to go have lunch. Well, we didn't get a chance to do that. But when I think of Majors, as you said it earlier, I think of it, that name being synonymous with Tennessee football. He was a great player at Tennessee, should have won the Heisman Trophy. He was a great coach at Tennessee. And I think he should be in the Hall of Fame as a coach as well, because he rebuilt three programs. And the thing to hold against him is that if you didn't win 60% of your games, you don't get to go in the Hall of Fame. Well, that's ridiculous if you took over at Iowa State and Pitt and the problem that they had. And then you came back to try to rebuild Tennessee, and it took a while. But I just thought, and the other thing about Majors is he wasn't a football one-track mind coach. He liked the symphony. He liked history. He liked reading. He liked traveling. He had a lot of interest. And I always thought he was great in dealing with the fan base when he was out signing autographs and meeting folks. I always thought he did a great job of representing Tennessee in that fashion.
Majors led Pittsburgh to a national championship and an undefeated season in 1976. He obviously endured a lot of success at Tennessee. We had Kevin Skarbinski on yesterday telling us stories about Pat Dye and what made him so successful. So I'll ask you the same thing. Since you were close to Majors, just like he was close to Dye, what made Johnny Majors a successful? Why did it work? What made him so successful?
One, I think he was a great teacher. Secondly, in regard to that, I think that he knew football very well because he played both ways in college. Very good defensive back, played kind of like quarterback position in the wing tee. He also was a punter, so he did everything on the football field, and I think that allowed him also to be a really good teacher. The other thing is he paid attention to details. If he saw a receiver not running the right route or an offensive lineman taking the wrong step, he would jump in there and make sure they did it the right way. He also demanded excellence. Now, sometimes, and he and I discussed this, but sometimes I thought he went a little bit too far, in particular with his assistant coaches. There was a time later that he acknowledged to me, yeah, there were a couple of them. I did go a little bit too far with my demanding excellence. But he said, I'm not going to apologize for demanding excellence from my assistant coaches and my players. And I think that's what it was. No detail unturned, his knowledge of the game, his ability to teach, and demanding excellence.
Jimmy, did the relationship between Philip Fulmer and Johnny Majors get any better over the years?
Not really. And it kind of saddened me in that regard. But John Majors never got over the situation. He felt like Philip Fulmer did some untoward things in terms of getting his job, and he never forgave Fulmer for that. I do know that Philip Fulmer reached out to Coach Majors a number of times trying to smooth things over, and Coach Majors wasn't interested in that, and that's a shame. But I hated that because it left the Vol Nation, many people in the Vol Nation, split. Some were Majors guys, some were Fulmer guys, and you really don't want that. Two of the three best coaches in your program's history weren't getting along, and I did not think that was healthy for Tennessee sports.
Talking to Jimmy Hyams, great perspective on the life of Coach Johnny Majors, who passed away at age 85 today. And Jimmy, let's go back to the chapter of him as a player, because maybe some fans, it's a little more fresh in their mind, his history as the coach at Tennessee, but he was a tremendous player, and a lot of people thought he maybe should have won the Heisman Trophy back in the day.
Yeah, he was known as the Huntland Hornet, and so he weighed about 140 pounds. And so the coach that recruited him to Tennessee told Nealon that he weighed 160. So basically he lied to him. And so anyway, so Majors gets up there, and I think Nealon looks at him like, wait a minute, this guy doesn't look like he weighs that much. But he got out there, and he was able to make a lot of people miss him because he was very quick and had good moves, very elusive. And so he realized, he called the family back after early practice as a freshman and said, hey, I can play at this level. So he goes on to be a star player. 1956, he leads the team to an undefeated regular season and loses a Heisman to Paul Hornung. Paul Hornung was playing at Notre Dame. He was on a 2-18. The great story about that is that Gus Manning was the sports information director at Tennessee at that time. And so John Majors used to get on Gus Manning about, how in the world did you let somebody from a losing team beat me out when I did all this and I was on under 15? So Majors accused Gus Manning of buying mint juleps to Paul Hornung when they'd go to the Kentucky Derby. And Gus Manning didn't deny that. So anyway, Majors was getting on Gus about that, how in the world did you let that guy beat me out for the Heisman Trophy and I finished second? And Gus said, I had to work like hell to get you into second place. So that's kind of the relationship they had. But Majors was a tremendous player. I thought he'd be a really good NFL player. I'm not sure exactly all the reasons. I know he was very small. That probably contributed to it. But as a player, he was very hard to tackle. He was a decent passer. He could punt. And he was very smart, had great knowledge of the game. And I think all those things, with that versatility, allowed him to be a great college football player.
Well, you know, it's interesting as you look, you know, you think back to the 1970s, Tony Dorsett, undefeated team for Pittsburgh, and then he comes back to his alma mater. And Jimmy, it had to be interesting to watch. You know, it's always tricky sometimes, I think maybe more tricky than people would believe, when you come home, basically, and you coach your alma mater. If you're not winning big, there's a lot of pressure. And it took a couple years before he really got his teams cranked up at Tennessee with the kind of success. It didn't happen overnight.
No, it didn't. And in fact, there was a lot of discussion. If he'd been coaching now and come back to Tennessee, he'd have been fired after 3 or 4 years. They weren't very good. It took him a long time to rebuild it. Bill Battle, and he's a great man, but he'd kind of let the program slide. They had not done well in recruiting, so the cupboard was really bare. And there were a couple of really good wins along the way, upset Notre Dame in like 1979, but they didn't really, and they beat Alabama and snapped an 11-game losing streak in 1982. But the 82, 83, 84 teams were pretty good, not great, but pretty good. And people were just getting really impatient about, when's this thing going to turn around? Because Tennessee hadn't won the SEC since 1969. At that time, it was the longest drought in program history. But then comes the 1985 season, and Tony Robinson's a great quarterback. They have a great start. The only loss that is to Florida in the first half of the year. Robinson goes down against Alabama. Darrell Dickey, the AD son, comes in, takes over quarterback, and manages them to I think they've won tie, and they won the rest of the games, including the big win over Miami. And, boy, when they beat Miami and they went down to the Sugar Bowl, that was an incredible scene to see that. But that's when it really got turned around. And so Majors won the SEC in 85, 89, and 90. Those were his 3 years to win the SEC. But it did take a long time to get it turned around, in large part because he inherited just a bare cupboard of talent when he got to Tennessee.
Jimmy, I always will remember that win over Vinny Testaverde and company, that great Miami team under Jimmy Johnson. Would you say that that was his biggest win as the coach? As you mentioned, they won a lot of games after, and they became much more consistent, and the foundation was built for when Philip Fulmer took over, where they really got to the top almost year in and year out during the 90s. But I felt like that was a huge tipping point when they were able to beat Miami on such a big stage in that Sugar Bowl.
100%. That was enormous. It was a great Miami team. That Miami team ended up putting 21 players in the NFL. I think everybody on offense and defense made it except for one guy. I bet that guy felt pretty bad. But, yeah, they were unreal. Vinny Testaverde would win the Heisman Trophy the next year. Jimmy Johnson, the coach, when he was at New Orleans, and I'm paraphrasing, basically said, it's not a matter of whether we're going to beat Tennessee, it's by how much. And Miami was in the national championship picture, and if they had a big win over Tennessee, they could win the national title. Well, Tennessee comes in as a decider. They're only like an 8-point underdog, but nobody really gave much of a chance to win the game. And then they end up blowing out Miami 35-7. They had an incredible defensive game plan to confuse Testaverde, and so they wiped Miami off the map. And I'm telling you, and I was at that game, there must have been 60 to 65,000 Tennessee fans in the Superdome. You couldn't hardly find a Miami fan, and by the second half, they were all gone anyway. But it was an incredible sea of orange. They also dominated the French Quarter. If you went to a restaurant, they're serving beignets. Everybody was eating the beignet was dressed in orange. It was just amazing the way Tennessee took over New Orleans and the Superdome that night. And I thought that, to me, I still, when I look back at it, and I know Tennessee won a national championship out in Tempe, but it's hard for me to look at a better moment in Tennessee football in all the years I've covered them than the night they beat Miami in the Sugar Bowl.
We're talking to Jimmy Himes, who has covered the Vols for a long time and just radio, of course, for the Sports Animal, WNML, in Knoxville. And Jimmy, as I sit here listening to these stories, obviously I'm the young pup on the show, so I don't remember Coach Major's time in Knoxville. I was very, very young when he left, and a lot of my memories as a kid is with Philip Fulmer. So I bring that up to ask somebody my age, 33, that needs to know something about Johnny Majors and his time that hasn't already been said. What is something that a young Vol, you know, for a Vols fan or a non-Vols fan, that they need to know?
Wow, that's a great question. It's hard to answer what they might not know. I do think when you look at the Majors family, when you look at the fact that he had two or three brothers that played at Tennessee, and his brother Bobby was an All-American player at Tennessee, they were just ingrained in Tennessee. The one thing about him, I touched on this earlier, but he was well-rounded. He loved to travel, read books, loved the symphony, loved history. And when he came back to Tennessee from Pittsburgh after his 4-year stint there, he started a monthly lunch club. And I attended it. I spoke at it. And it was a lot of fun, but he would have a wide range of guests. It wasn't just football guests. It wasn't just sports guests. He would have somebody that might have been a general in a war, or somebody that had some history knowledge of some event, and he would have people from the symphony over there. He just had a wide range of guests that he would bring by there, and that was the thing about him that a lot of people might not have realized, was how diverse he was. Maybe I'm wrong, but when I look at somebody like Nick Saban, I think football 100% of the time. But Majors wasn't like that. He loved football, coached it, but he also had a lot of interest outside of football, which I thought made him unique. And also, he was a great personality. He loved to get out and mix and mingle with people, and he certainly appreciated the fan base that he had, because I witnessed many times when he would sign autograph after autograph after autograph and never complain about it. He just did it because he felt like that was part of his obligation.
Jimmy, of course, we talked about his relationship or lack of relationship, I guess I should say, with Philip Fulmer. But what was it like with some of the other coaches, whether it was Lane Kiffin for the year or Butch Jones, Derek Dooley, and, of course, Jeremy Pruitt now? Did he have any type of relationship with those coaches?
Yes, every one of them. And, in fact, Lane Kiffin really embraced him. And that's the first time I remember him, majors, going back to practice, and that was in 2009. And then Butch Jones did it. Derek Dooley did it. Butch Jones did it. Jeremy Pruitt did it. And so, yeah, they reached out, had him come to practice. He was welcomed in the press box. He was welcomed at a variety of events over there. And so and that was good. That needed to happen. Even if there was a rift between him and the AD, that needed to happen. And through a lot of that time, Philip Fulmer wasn't around. So, I thought that was a good situation. One thing that was kind of funny was when Majors came back, he felt like the entire campus was his personal parking lot. So he parked illegally on a street named Johnny Majors Boulevard, and he got a ticket. And so one of the administrators in the athletic department said, we can't give him a ticket for parking on his boulevard. So they ripped up the ticket so he wouldn't have to pay for it. But just stuff like that. He illegally parked another time on the street, and people didn't know who it was. So he started honking at him, like, what are you doing? You know, get out of the way. So he thought they recognized him. So he gets out of the car, and he's waving at all of them. Hey, thank you, you know. And they're all mad at him for parking illegally because they couldn't get around him. So he was a character. But he was just a lot of fun to be with, and I really, really did appreciate my relationship with him.
Man, those are great stories. Jimmy Himes is with us. Jimmy, I can tell, you know, I start thinking back. I try to put myself in his shoes, you know, the competitor that he was. He had the great success at Pittsburgh. It didn't end the way he wanted to when he was coaching Tennessee. But the going back to Pittsburgh, you know, he never had much success there. Do you think he realized how tough of a challenge it was going to be? The program was in such a different place when he went back for a second time.
I think he realized it, but I think it was also harder than he thought. But he was not going to be. One of the things that happened when he went to Pitt the first time, and they were awful. If they weren't 0-11, they were 1-10. They were just terrible when he got there. But at that time, he could go out and sign almost an unlimited amount. I think he may have signed 80-something players his first year at Pitt. One of them happened to be Tony Dorsett. But he loaded the boat with all these recruits, and it ticked off Joe Paterno at Penn State because he thought there was a unspoken rule that you couldn't sign more than about 45. Well, going back to Pitt the second time around, there were recruiting restrictions, and the program had fallen off again. The facilities were no good. I actually went up there to do a story about it, and it was awful. And it was a monumental challenge to get that thing turned around. And I think if he gave him some truth serum, he kind of wishes maybe he hadn't done that. But he felt like he still had some good years in coaching left. He was in his 50s. He was still in his 50s, and I think he wanted to kind of prove that he still had it. But going back to Pittsburgh was just too much of a task to get that thing turned around. And to some people, it diminishes legacy a little bit, but I don't feel that way. I think that's a little bit unfair just because I know how difficult of a job it would have been to turn that program around at that time. One funny story about that when I went up there. So I was talking to him during this long feature piece, and I said, where'd you go? He said, well, I went to an auction. And I said, did you get anything? He said, yeah, I got auction. He said, I bid on this item. I got free gas for a year for my company vehicle. And he said, and then I realized the mistake I made. I said, what was the mistake? He said, they gave me free gas, so I didn't have to buy it. So I wasted all this money buying free gas for a year, and the university provided it for me.
That is fantastic. By the way, one year we were doing a player show at Cool Springs Galleria, and the player guest that night was Albert Hainsworth, and he was late to the show. We couldn't figure out why. It's because he had also parked illegally, and he was trying to talk himself out of getting that ticket. I think he ended up doing that. He had to move the car, but he was late to the show because of that. Jimmy, great stuff. Really appreciate it. That was fantastic stories, and we appreciate the visit today. Thanks for doing this.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me, and you guys have a great afternoon.
You do the same. That is Jimmy Himes, afternoon host there on WNML, the Sports Animal in Knoxville. He's been in that market for a long time, and as you can tell, had an unbelievable relationship with Johnny Majors, dead today at age 85. We will come back. More of Darren Donick and Chase on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Caleb Joseph, go. If we just had the visual right now, this is where you need the video. Caleb Joseph on the air drums. We had a really good talk with him earlier in the week. You know, during this, we had on former Predators captain Shea Weber. By the way, we appreciate Jimmy Himes for joining us. That was great storytelling by him and lending real insight on the life and career of Johnny Majors. But I saw where Shea Weber put a statement out. And I don't know. It looks like the Canadians are the one who put the statement out. So I guess Shea is probably not on any social media. That would be my guess.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. That's usually not him. But the statement says...
Not his main department?
No. Shea's, as we've talked about many, many times, which is why we appreciated him coming on that day. He's a pretty private dude. And you're not going to get a lot of stuff out there. And social media would not seem like Shea Weber. But the statement that they released, the Montreal Canadiens, was, "I have been baffled and frustrated since I first saw the disturbing and senseless killing of George Floyd. I have not been sure how to express my feelings. Growing up in a small town never afforded me the worldly experiences to understand racism or to ever really think about this issue as a young individual. My eyes have been open to the realities that many people who don't look like me face on a daily basis. Racism is very real and must be called out. Sports is a unifying force. It brings people together. We now need to be united in this fight and work together. I don't have the solutions and can't speak from experience or tell someone who has dealt with racism how they should feel. But we can all listen. We need to push for equality and push our resources and voices together to bring change. We can make the world better by working together. My thoughts are with George Floyd and his family and everyone, and who has been a victim of racism and discrimination." That coming from former Predators captain, now Canadiens captain, Shea Weber. Well said.
Usually,
yep.
Oh yeah, and as you would expect, a classy, thoughtful touch from Shea Weber. And I think he expressed in there what a lot of hockey players, I think, are trying to grasp. And that's been a challenge in the NHL. I know there is a strong desire to make the game more diverse, right? You hear it every year coming from the league office. You know, hockey is for everybody. They're trying to embrace. But it is slow just trying to get, you know, different cross sections of the population in North America playing at a younger age. And you've heard, you know, guys like Evander Kane and some others, you know, speaking out about some of the challenges there. And I think Shea, I liked his awareness. He was basically saying, you know, I didn't grow up really, you know, living some of the, and maybe some, I think, unaware of some of the challenges that have gone on just because of, you know, the population in Canada. It's becoming more diverse. But I think that's a great thing to think about. And I can tell Shea has given it some thought. And some of the words, I think, by some of the players from the NHL have expressed that as well. So I, again, hoping that there are some positive steps taken here with all of the, you know, the stuff that has gone on that has been really, really tough for all of us, but it is certainly given us pause to think, and I think you heard that expressed by Shea Weber.
And if you know him or don't, but you've heard us talk about him, who we did get to know very well, that's him. Okay, just so you know, that's his words.
Yeah, you know it's
real.
That was,
you
not written
sincere
by someone in an office.
No,
with the Canadians. Okay, for him and signed his name. That's Shea Weber.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's the real type of person he is. And that's what, you know, I guess I didn't know him on the level you guys did, because you got to know him a lot longer than I did. But, you know, that's how he is. He's just very, as you said, he's private, but he's also, when he has something to say, you tend to listen to it because it has a lot of meaning behind it. So kudos to Shea.
Good stuff. I wanted to pass along. There's been a lot of news that has happened today. We touched on Johnny Majors there with Jimmy Himes. Of course, just sad this week. Not been a good week for the SEC and legendary coaches, Pat Dye and now Johnny Majors. The news coming out after the show yesterday, later in the day, that NASCAR would indeed be returning to Nashville on the Cup side, which was vitally important. And it will return to the Nashville Super Speedway. We also learned today that right now it's a parking lot for cars, for Nissan cars to be exact. And so they'll have to move those. And it is active. It is open. And I guess somewhat maintained from what we can tell. And so it'll be curious to see what Dover Motorsports puts into that place, that facility that they still own, they never sold. Which was also probably news for a lot of people because it seemed like many years ago that it was set to be sold and it never took place. That deal fell through. But I guess there's been upkeep. I don't know to what level. I guess it's safe to say it doesn't look like Greer. We used to always say that once they opened up the new park. Greer just sat there and, you know, Ozzy too, and just cried because it just turned into I don't know. It was a bad sight. You're right. Like it was just a bad sight.
A wheat field almost.
That is,
you know, you kind of get the feeling if you were to walk through the old outfield at Greer, you might have a lot of ticks on your ankles and legs because the grass was so high. Are you guys surprised that it's Nashville Super Speedway? That really took
very
me back.
Surprised.
I asked you guys that question. I asked you guys that very question a few weeks ago. Could that place ever be revived? But with all the talk we've had about working the fairgrounds area, to get that curveball right there, that completely shocked me.
Well, we had a really good conversation with John Roberts, who lives here in Nashville and can be heard. In fact, he's on the air right now on Sirius XM on the NASCAR channel. He does a daily show, and we had a really good conversation with him, and he was lending some real insight to some people that he's talked to in NASCAR circles. And this seems like a play and a push from NASCAR toward the city of Nashville and the mayor, John Cooper. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's time for them to stop dragging their feet and get involved. Like, let's go. The sport wants to come here, and you know where they want to be. Let's go. Let's stop dragging your feet. This is a push from them. Now they've got 4 years to figure it out because it's a four-year deal. And so it's going to be up to the city. If they blow this, this is going to be really a really bad look, a really bad look, because everybody knows the fairgrounds makes a ton of sense. That area needs to be revitalized. It's already on its way to being revitalized with the new MLS stadium. That would be the icing on the cake. I mean, you're talking about a complete transformation. You have a cup race and an MLS stadium in that area. Holy cow, with all the other stuff going on, you're talking about change. New people in this town, you know, wouldn't even know how bad the old was if you looked at it, you know, 5-10 years from now. They wouldn't believe you. That's how different it would be. So it's up to the city, you know, and if they drop the ball on this, they deserve all the pushback and blowback they get. Yep. From the public. They deserve all the negative criticism they will get for dropping the ball. The drivers have made it abundantly clear they want a race at the fairgrounds. They want a NASCAR event, a cup race on a short track in Nashville. So, I mean, John Roberts painted the picture if Nashville would get their stuff together and the mayor's office would get their stuff together, that there could be two cup races in this market. There could be one at the fairgrounds and one at Nashville Super Speedway. Think about that. We would go from 36 years it's been since we've seen a cup race. It'll be 37 when they have this one next year. 37 years, a market without a cup race. And, you know, at some point we will be talking about going from that to two cup races on the calendar schedule or on the calendar year in the same market. And it would also be a first of two cup races in the same market with different ownership groups. That does not exist on the calendar. That does not exist right now in the sport, and that would be the case here in Nashville if it happened.
Well, I'm still confused. Great. I wish I had heard the interview that you guys had, because on the one hand, I thought the whole Super Speedway thing was completely dead, gone. You know, never even, I'd never heard it even considered you know, the last several years.
Yeah, Nick Saban said it was dead, buried, and gone. Because that's true.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. We could play the clip. You know, but, you know, as far as the fairgrounds, I remember not too long ago, you know, us having a pretty heated discussion about the whole dynamic. This is all before everything started happening, you know, in early March that have created all kinds of challenges. But there was a time where they were basically holding up the soccer stadium to try to help the cause of the fairgrounds, right? So they were going to – the city was going to bat for the fairgrounds, at least the way I saw it. And, of course, once the tornado hit and all that stuff, I know they've had so much to deal with, the pandemic and now all, you know, everything that's happening. Now, I would imagine that it's not as big a priority as it was, but at a time, they were the mayor was really pushing to try to elevate the fairgrounds. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong.
No.
He is.
So what happened? I don't understand how it went from there to all of us were going back out. No, because to be honest, I was excited about the idea of an event in that area in the fairgrounds. I'm not as excited as much as we've been out there and we've covered plenty of races out there and it's a great facility, but I was a little bit more excited for other reasons to have it in a new spot and a new old spot, if you will,
sure.
The tradition that you have at the old Speedway.
Yeah, and that certainly is still on the table. That's, you know, that's what Darren was mentioning that John Roberts brought up and SMI that is trying to revitalize the fairgrounds made a statement of, you know, we're still having talks with Nashville and we still want to have talks. So that is not dead at all. This was a tweet last night from Matt Weaver. He's the associate editor of Auto Week. I've been told the Nashville Super Speedway decision is meant to nudge and encourage Tennessee and Nashville officials to invest in the fairgrounds in the hopes of having the race there. That has been a consistent thing that's been out there because NASCAR's been ready. NASCAR wants to come. They're ready to be here. I mean, they brought their banquet here. They have pretty much said, hi, hello, we want to get together. So this is, I mean, now it's, you know, they were going to revitalize the schedule anyway, revamp the schedule for 2021. There was no way, no how that they were going to be able to have the fairgrounds ready for next year. And so the opportunity presented itself, and as John Roberts explained to us, Dover was going to lose a race. The attendance has not been very good, so NASCAR was going to move a race no matter what. So if you look at it from a business standpoint for them, they still have this track that's just sitting there. It totally makes sense for them to go to NASCAR and go, hey, we know you love Nashville. We still have the Super Speedway. We can dump some money into it, get it ready to go. Would you guys, if you're going to take a race from us, can we at least keep it at a different location? And that's what ended up happening. But, you know, I still hope they get the deal done with the fairgrounds. I mean, that's where everybody wants to be. But this seems like it makes sense to get the sport here starting next year. I mean, it's right away. You don't have to wait anymore. You don't have to sit and talk about it. I mean, it's going to happen. So I think that's ultimately what led to that decision.
I said earlier on the show, if we would have assessed odds, we got our buddy Jimmy Shapiro to give us odds that there would be a cup race in Nashville. And we, right before we got off the airwaves yesterday, in a year from now, what kind of odds do you think we would have gotten?
Plus 10,000 is what I said this morning.
Really, really good odds where we could have been very, very happy if we would have taken those odds because it would have made us a lot of money. Those odds would have been very, very high. I don't think anybody could have seen not only the announcement coming after we get off the air yesterday, but the announcement coming, and oh, by the way, they'll be here in a year from now, probably.
Yeah.
I guess at least the hints are it'll be in the month of June. That could change. There's no, that's not definite. It's not for sure. That's some rumblings out there that it could be in the month of June on the schedule next year. But
there is a conference call today with NASCAR officials in Dover, so we could have more. We could get more information today about the date and things like that. So coming up later this afternoon,
Willie, maybe we should get Cliff Hawks on the show and see if he can lend some more insight to what we should expect a year from now.
Yeah, where is Cliff these days?
The last time I heard, he was in Knoxville.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Cliff spent a lot of time on our show. That's for sure, back in the day.
Yes, he did. He is who ran the Nashville Super Speedway. For those who don't know who Cliff Hawks is.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering. because I just went as a fan. This was way before my career began, but it was fun. I mean, I definitely had some good times out there with my dad, my uncle, and a couple friends. You know, we saw the Busch races and the truck races and ARCA. I never made the IRL, and I regret that. I wish I'd gone to the IRL.
That was very, very popular. And quite honestly, my favorite, if I'm just being truthful. It was my favorite. I loved the open wheel cars out there. It was awesome. Let's go to Doug. He wants to weigh in. What's up?
Hello, guys.
Hey.
Here's Doug from Nashville. Would you believe that I was an original worker for the Super Speedway out there?
Really? What did you do?
Yes. I started off as a pit crew fireman and then worked my way into the cleanup truck that they created, a third cleanup truck for me. And I have to say that it was a good experience at the beginning that I was there. And everybody that came said that the Speedway was nice. They took it as a weekend off because the other racetracks that they went to, and we were professional, we were good. And did I say we were good? We were good. Just didn't have a Sunday. You can't create a Sunday. But everybody that came said that that place was what it needed to be, in the middle of nowhere. Nobody, you know, complaining about the noise. People, you know, race car fans, and I wasn't a race car fan. I was just a worker to do what they want to do, say what they want to say, and it was a perfect fit. You know, but it just didn't happen. But, you know, for personal reasons, I would like to see it come back because, you know, we were all talking and mumbling after we saw it yesterday, because it'd be good to get the old band back together just for one grand finale for the one that we didn't get to have. But nice place. It's very clean, and it was just it was a good time to be around racing, especially with the way that the officials, the staff, the emergency people all bragged about when they came to play what it's called. It was just like a weekend off because it wasn't any, you know, roughshod looking place. You know, we weren't just a bunch of hillbillies that just wanted to hang out at racetracks. We were professionals, and they really enjoyed it. It was fun.
Did you have any story or any memory you could share of something that happened during a race?
I have a good memory because, you know, I do have those things. I remember when
I'm not asking you to put anybody on the list. I'm just saying you have a good story.
No. What's his name? The owner of the coach of the Redskins.
Joe Gibbs?
Joe Gibbs was there, and people were just going goo-goo, ga-ga. And, of course, me, not a race fan. I'm just there to work. And he turned and asked someone, who's your favorite Redskins? Because if you're the coach of the Redskins, I love the Redskins. And he said, who's your favorite player? And the guy, being a NASCAR fan, never knew anything about football. He said, Danny White. And I said, and I just said under my breath, I said, it's got to be Darrell Green, fastest man in the NFL. And Coach Gibbs turns around and he said, you like Mr. Green, Darrell Green? I said, yeah. I said, he wasn't a track star. You remember the, you know, fast race they had on ABC Sports? I said, he won that. But he was also the face of United Way. I said, fastest man until Champ Bailey came, you know, shared all that I knew. And he said, I'd like to give you this book. It's a personal book of mine. And it was a book of his Bible verse that he cared a lot about. He was a good Christian man. He autographed it, and I still have it today.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Just great because story. I knew who Darrell Green was, and somebody just yelled out, Danny White.
Of all bad guesses you can make.
And he was a real nice man. He was very, you know, much into racing, but he really appreciated, you know, that I knew what was in the book. We talked for a moment about, he said, what's your favorite verse? And I told him Romans 8:28. All things work together. And he just was talking about things outside of football and racing. He just appreciated that I knew who Darrell Green was, knew about his history, and knew about the Redskins. But he was cool to be there. And they treated you like kings. And Danica Patrick was really nice. Some of her stories were pretty cool.
Wow, that's a first. Okay, that's the first I've heard of that. So that's actually breaking news. We should hit the breaking news sounder. Danica Patrick was nice. There we go. You just heard it here first. Doug on Darren, Donick, and Chase says Danica Patrick was nice.
Not Danny Patrick.
Danica Patrick took time to take pictures with us when everybody at the big NASCAR event was looking for her, and she was just standing there taking personal photos with us, giving us a few moments of her time. Very pretty.
Well, congratulations. You may be one of few that can tell that story. So,
she was
well
very
done.
Nice. Have a good day.
Doug, thanks, let us know when the band gets back together. That would be cool. Cool story.
Yes.
I said earlier on the show when you were away, Willie, we can now say a year from now that we have driven on a NASCAR Cup track.
Yeah,
we have been had our own personal vehicles on the same track as Cup drivers. How about that?
I just wish I had had a faster car.
Yeah, yeah. The Volvo just.
It just it didn't have a lot of.
Did I?
Didn't have a lot of oomph.
Didn't have a lot of juice,
a lot,
did it?
Not a lot. Not
need an adjustment.
I'm not sure I hit triple digits.
No, well, I'm not
sure.
I'm not sure I did either. I was nervous to do it.
I think I got close. We also had the station van taking some laps around there too. That thing wasn't going very fast either.
Well, the driver.
It was going about as fast.
The driver
as it could
got
go,
speeding
though.
Tickets all the time, so he did drive it fast.
Was that driver somebody we all know?
Oh yeah. No doubt. All right,
imagine that.
We will come back and wrap up the third hour of Darren Donick and Chase next. Chris Mason coming up at 1 o'clock, so we'll start the fourth and final hour with him. If you own or manage a small business and you're open, you want to let people know about it, we've got Free Business Friday, as we sit here on Wednesday, that you got an opportunity to jump in there. That's right, we're offering you free advertising to any local business that's safely open and working. That's a no-cost, no-catch offer for you. All you have to do is go to the GameNashville.com/FBF for more information. That's our website, GameNashville.com/FBF for more information. Free Business Friday is our way of supporting small businesses as we get through this together. Let's go to Brenda, who's on hold. She wants to weigh in. Brenda, what's up?
Oh, I wanted to talk to you about the racetrack, the one out in Lebanon. I don't like it. I don't like that they want to take it away from the racetrack in Nashville, because I've been to both. I grew up in Nashville and went to the one in Nashville all my life. I've been going 60 years. And I was out there in the one in Lebanon when Kyle Busch took the guitar and smashed it that Sam Ash painted, hand-painted for him. I don't like that. That's disrupting things that people have done by Nashvillians for the racetrack. I don't want it out there. I want it in Nashville for Nashvillians. The poor people can't drive all the way out there for a race.
Well, I think right now, as we've said, thank you for the phone call, that this is a ploy by NASCAR to push the city. I mean, it's no secret. They have made it abundantly clear to Nashville's mayor and the city that they want to be here and they want to bring a cup race. And this is a prime example of that. They're putting it to action, their words into actions, and their actions are a year from now there will be a cup race. And, yes, it's not at the fairgrounds, because the fairgrounds wouldn't be hosting a cup race a year from now. That's impossible. It's an impossible task. There's a lot of work and a lot of planning and a lot of things that have to go into reconfiguring, changing, upgrading, renovations, everything that goes into what it would take for that short track to host a cup race. They're going to need time, and this is now 4 years, and we'll see how those 4 years go. Either it could last and stay here, and we could be talking about two races. But, unfortunately, we remember that day. Not a banner day for Kyle Busch in this market. Sam Bass, may he rest in peace, they had the unique trophy for that race, a hand-painted Gibson guitar, and Kyle Busch won. Was it the Busch race? I don't know.
Nationwide.
What was it called by then? I can't remember
series.
The names. By then, they've had so many. Nationwide race. He gets the Sam Bass Gibson guitar, and he smashes it into pieces in front of Sam Bass.
And he has said that he regrets that. So he has. That was a younger Kyle Busch, and you can say what you want about Kyle Busch, and a lot of it is true. But he definitely regrets that now. To hear what she's saying, I get that, and I'm the same way, but it's what we've been saying all show. I mean, it's getting it to the market. It's getting it here. You have a track that's sitting there that will be ready to go sooner than the fairground. So while it may be a 4-year deal, who's to say that they won't be having cup racing at the fairgrounds in a couple of years if they get their stuff together. And by they, I mean Nashville. So, yeah, it's nothing's being taken away from Nashville, the fairgrounds, so to speak. It's just they had an offer that was ready to go before the fairgrounds. And that goes with some things we brought up of just trying to get things moving here in this city and in Davidson County, and hopefully this will help.
Remember, it's not a bad thing. We're not going to poo-poo
a
cup race coming to our city or to Middle Tennessee in the next year. We shouldn't be mad at that. That's not a bad thing. It's out in Gladeville. It's been a while since we've said Gladeville on this show. In fact, I can't even think of the last time I referenced Gladeville, Tennessee on this show. But it's out in the middle. It's off 840, right off the exit. And we actually brought this up earlier, and maybe you can help me with this, because, you know, I was always out there doing pre-race shows. So I would be out there, you know, 4 hours before the race. So I didn't really have to deal with traffic at all. And we were talking about if they, let's say, you know, I think the biggest crowd they had out there was around 50,000 for the open wheel. Maybe the first ever race had that. But I don't remember, I didn't recall any complaining, because we would, Cliff Hawks, I'd bring him up, we would have him, he would come on and do an hour and field calls from people buying tickets and people that attended the race or were going to attend the race. Do you remember any backlash or blowback of bad traffic, of people complaining about how hard it was to get in or get out? Do you remember that at all?
I never did. And I was one that wasn't always part of some pre-race shows. I was for some. But I think people got accustomed to it, right? I mean, sometimes when you have a sold-out crowd, you have to expect that there's going to be some traffic. I mean, I've been to races in Talladega and Atlantic. Atlanta, you want to talk about some traffic. I mean, that's what you have to expect, a certain amount of that. But I think they had a pretty good system. Remember, you could come in on, 840, right, from either direction. And so that helped get in there, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's right off of 840.
It's just right off 840. So, yeah, I mean, you came from either direction.
Right, but but that's my point, is you didn't have, it wasn't just like one road leading in there for a tiny town, Gladeville, right? I think they did about as well as they could to be able to bring traffic in. That was pretty well thought out. I don't think that was the issue. It became, I think, a little bit more, you tell me, Chase, just from a pure racing standpoint, I think that people did not think the track helped a lot for drama and stuff like that, right?
It was concrete,
but it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of great lead changes and excitement that took place due to the track.
Yeah, they would fan out and just wouldn't be close together, and whoever had the fastest car, and usually it wasn't always the pole sitter, but started close to the front, I mean, that's who won the race. I mean, there wasn't a lot of close calls. There may be one more other than this, but I remember when Michael Walter won there. I can't remember who he wrecked, but he wrecked somebody to win, basically. I mean, they were beating and banging on the final lap, and Michael spun the guy out and won the race. And that was probably the most exciting finish that I remember out there. There were some good races. I mean, there was definitely some good moments. But that's what has worried people in all this, is they're not going to be side by side. But when we were talking to John Roberts earlier, and I was explaining this, there's a compound called PJ1 that they put on the track, and that basically opens up another lane and gives more grip for the cars. And so they didn't have that before. I mean, this is a fairly new thing that they use, so they can use that, and that's going to help the racing some. Will it fix everything? No, but it'll help it.
Probably the two things that got the most national attention, we've already addressed one, the Kyle Busch slamming the guitar down. The other was before a race, Pastor Joe Nelms and his prayer to everyone.
Heavenly Father, we thank you tonight for all your blessings. You said in all things give thanks. So we want to thank you tonight for these mighty machines that you brought before us. Thank you for the Dodges and the Toyotas. Thank you for the Fords. And most of all, we thank you for Roush and Yates partnering to give us the power that we see before us tonight. Thank you for GM Performance Technology and the R07 engines. Thank you for Sunoco Racing Fuel and Goodyear Tires that bring performance and power to the track. Lord, I want to thank you for my smoking hot wife tonight, Lisa. My two children, Eli and Emma, or as we like to call them, the little E's. Lord, I pray you bless the drivers and use them tonight. May they put on a performance worthy of this great track. In Jesus' name, boogity, 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 amen.
I love that so much.
Oh, my.
Oh, man, I forgot about that.
I think that was the last race there.
Yeah, well, I think it was. I think you're right. I think that was the last race there.
I remember that.
It was 2011.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that and just going, oh, man, this is fantastic. So they need to get him back for the first cup race. I'm just saying. That'd be cool.
That was fantastic. I don't know where Pastor Joe Nelms, we haven't done a follow-up on him 9 years later, but it's a good question. I did see where it looks like Jonathan Vilma is reportedly going to replace Ronde Barber on Fox's broadcast lineup for NFL. So that was pretty interesting. We will come back, start the final hour with Chris Mason, our weekly chat with him, next on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Hey, guys. Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.